Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. Today, we're going to be test talking with Paul Grazaffi as he explains responsible ways to approach automation, as well as some of the knowledge we need in order to be responsible. He also shares insight into automation responsibility from his own career, including how to use proper judgment with all our testing efforts. So listen up and learn how to avoid test automation forays into irresponsibility. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Paul. Welcome back to Test Talks.
Hey, thanks, Joe.
Awesome. Today, I'd like to talk about your upcoming keynote at STPCon. With great judgment comes great responsibility. Before we get into it, for the folks that didn't catch your awesome episode 90 of Test Talks, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself or what you've been up to since the last time we spoke?
Sure. My name is Paul Grazaffi. I'm currently an automation principal automation architect at a company called Magenic. We do consulting. That is a change since the last time we talked. So I moved over to Magenic in November. It was one of those opportunities that I just had to jump on, and I've been happy there so far. It's been a real great experience. They absolutely support the writing and the speaking part of my career. So I get to do things like come on Test Talks and chat with you to help promote things that we're doing. So as far as me, I've worked in several different technology sectors, and I've been a part of automation initiatives in each one of those for all of my 20-plus year career now.
So at a high level, what's your keynote about? Because this quote reminds me of the Spider-Man quote that Uncle Ben gave, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. What do you mean by with great judgment comes great responsibility?
And that is where I lifted that from. I struggled multiple different times with titles for this particular presentation that STP asked me to come and give as a keynote, which I'm quite honored to do. But yes, the idea is that responsibility to be responsible means to exercise good judgment. And in order to exercise good judgment, you have to have some information. You have to have some knowledge. So what I do is I give some examples throughout history where there's been some questionable judgments made and some negative impacts that have come out of that. Then I take the attendees through making responsible decisions and exercising good judgment about automation. Not so much on the pitfalls aspect, but more on the here's some things that we need to keep in mind and understand as we go forward. And it's all centered around being a good judge of situations, and where we don't think we can exercise good judgment, we need additional knowledge in order to ensure or to at least raise the chances that we're making a good judgment on tool selection, on direction for our automation, whether we should automate or not. And that is how we are responsible with our automation initiatives.
Wow, it sounds really cool. So I guess, how do you know when to make a judgment? How do you know you have enough information to make a judgment?
You never really know. It's kind of like that whole thing where you can have a million test cases and you cannot prove that a software system works correctly. But with one test case, you can prove that it doesn't work. And it's the same idea. The more that you have, the better judgment you're going to be able to make, because you have more of the information at your fingertips around what it is you're going to need. So if you're not comfortable making the decision, if there's too much risk in the decision, if the number of unknowns for your risk profile is too high, then you may want to do a little more homework before you make that decision so you can exercise good judgment there. there's so much irresponsibility in the software world in general, but particularly around automation and automation for automation's sake. And as you and I both know, and many of the listeners are going to know, automation is a means to an end. It's not an end itself. So if you are pushing for automation because we, quote, need to do automation, or if you're pushing for 100% automation because if we have everything automated, then it's all tested and we won't have any bugs, those are not responsible ways to approach this. Those are not business savvy ways to approach the implementation of anything, automation being the particular thing that I'm talking about.
Awesome. Now, what do you mean by it's irresponsible? How does someone know that where they're getting the information is correct or not? Especially if they're new to the industry, they may go to a certain vendor maybe, and they're being told, you know, you need to do automation. How do you guide someone to say, here are the correct sources, or not the correct, but here are a couple of sources you may want to double check that particular statement to make sure it actually is in line with what is being responsible and what is being irresponsible?
So it truly is caveat emptor. It truly is. You have to understand where things fit. I like third-party software. I like vendor-supplied software. There's nothing wrong with it. Yep. But understand that what the vendor is going to tell you is that this tool is going to work for you because it should, not because it does. They can't know for 100% that it works for you. A responsible way is to say, that sounds really good. Let me take it and try it for X number of days or weeks or whatever the agreement between you and the vendor is, and prototype with it. Try something with it. But when you try something, don't just try to go to Google and automate against it, or Dave Hafner's The Internet Site. I mean, both of those are interesting things to try to automate against. But if the tool works for those, that's great. But that's not what your product is. Your product is not a test website. Your product is your product. You should take this tool and try to automate with it, with the people that are going to be doing the automation, against something tricky, against something that you know you may have some issues with this tool because it's hard to do by hand, or you've tried another tool and it didn't work so well on this one aspect of your product. Make sure you do these proof of concepts and prototypes focused on that. But then you have to step back and take the bigger look at it and say, is this going to be valuable? Think about a budget, right? You have so much money to spend. You have $100,000, $1 million, whatever it is for a department. And some of that's going to go toward equipment. Some of it's going to go toward people. Some of it's going to go toward software. And if you're going to put some of that money toward software package X, let's say a test automation package, well, that money is no longer available for something else that may or may not have had greater value. So you have to look at this, again, in a bigger picture, responsibly, with a business hat on, with business glasses on, and make a business decision with this technology data that you have.
Awesome. And Paul, you know, we spoke about this kind of about this on a webinar we did recently together, and it kind of reminds me of the discussion we had on what's the best test tool to use for a team. And I think we both agreed, and I think you just brought up an excellent point. You probably want to try it in a proof of concept against your real application.
So, absolutely.
You know, we mentioned we like vendor tools, but they're not necessarily always the best. The flip side is a lot of people like open source tools, and they would never look at a vendor-based tool. So I guess, can you just go over, in that particular webinar, you gave a really great 3 points that you think someone should always use when choosing an automation test tool. I wonder if we could touch on those a little bit.
Absolutely. And I like vendor tests. I like vendor tools. I also like open source tools. I'm largely tool agnostic. I mean, I've got the ones that I've got some experience in, so I tend to prefer those just because my ramp up time is more shallow. But I'm a big fan of right tool for the job, even if that means I have to learn something I don't know already. But as far as the three parts of the automation ecosystem that you're talking about, I like to look at strategy. I like to look at audience, and I like to look at environment. So briefly, the strategy is, what are you trying to do and how do you want to do it? And that needs to align not only with the business goals, but also with your testing strategy. If your automation strategy is at odds with your testing strategy, then you're doing it wrong. Those are not two different things. They're two sides of the same coin. Automation really is an extension or a force multiplier of what testers are doing. The automation's there to help them do their job, not to be a competition for their job or to go off and do something different. On testers, so then we talk about the audience. The audience is who is either directly or indirectly interested in the automation. Directly interested tends to be your testers, your QA people. In some organizations, the developers are directly interested because they are the ones all are going to be typing the keys and getting the initial reports and acting on the results of this automation. But then you have the indirect people as well. Those are the indirect audience as well. Those are the people who are tangentially interested because it affects them one way or the other. Either they want to see some distilled reports, if they're maybe a product owner or a manager, or if you're going to be interacting with your release management team or your security team or your ops team. Those teams are also part of the audience indirectly because they're not typing the keys of the automation, but what you're doing with the automation is likely to affect them one way or the other. And then the third part is the environment. Where are you running it? How are you going to run it? What is your product like? What sort of state is it in? Is it brand new, you know, greenfield? Is it you've got some legacy components and some new components? Or are you building on something that's there? As you answer each of those questions and as you investigate each of those three parts of your ecosystem, you're going to get more information. You're going to get more knowledge. And with more and more knowledge, the number of tool choices and really, you know, tool approaches and other aspects of this engagement, they're going to change. Things that were appropriate, hey, you know, we have 20 tools to pick from. It needs to run on these five different operating systems. Okay, now we have four tools to pick from. Those are the different types of things that can filter down all these tens and tens of tool and framework choices into a manageable set where you say, which one is most likely to fit my need? Let's do a prototype or proof of concept with that.
All right, Paul. So I kind of have a question out of right field almost. I've been reading a lot about, and you probably have heard this, is a lot of times we make decisions based on irrational feelings, but we use rational beliefs or rational reasons why we chose that irrational choice. So do you have any advice in your keynote on how to avoid this?
Well, feelings are going to play a part into everything because all of your experience sort of builds on what your knowledge is, right? You've got a history, you've done things, you've been successful at some things haven't turned out quite so well. Then you get all this new knowledge and everything there is going to sort of shade and color how you make decisions. Your innate biases and prejudices of liking this technology versus that technology, or you know, this operating system or that operating system, what have you. Some of that is going to be gut feel, which some might say is irrational. Some it's going to be history. You've learned it, but you don't really know why it wasn't a good idea to have done that thing, but you wouldn't do it again. That's all going to play in. How do you avoid that? Number one, try to be self-aware of those things. I've got certain biases, right? I do like certain languages over other languages. I try not to let that influence me because I know I have those biases there. Having a sounding board, having your yin to your yang, where you can bring it to someone, a trusted partner, and say, look, this is what I'm thinking of doing. Here's the mountain of data I've put together. That person will be able to look at those things to some extent with less emotion, or at the very least with different emotion, because they'll have different baggage. They'll have different experiences that they'll bring to the table, coloring their perceptions differently. And if you both sort of look and go, yeah, this looks like the right thing to do, great. Then maybe you're on to something. If you're at odds, maybe you need to open it up to some other avenues. And then always I poke fun at people that you know, Google for answers and stuff. But I Google for answers daily. I do. That is how I find stuff. I'm doing a research project at work right now on automation and AI. And I didn't know where to start, so I started with Google. And then I just started untangling the Christmas tree lights there and letting me go from place to place to place. So I started forming my own opinions and my own approaches to how I would jump up and go on these things.
All right, Paul. So I think you brought up a lot of great points. Once again, I've been reading a book called The Originals, and I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on this. If I read this correctly, if I'm remembering correctly, they recommend a devil's advocate. But a lot of times a devil advocate isn't really someone that really is for a solution or an approach. They just may be taking the part of playing the devil's advocate. And what they recommended is actually getting a hardcore, you know, vendor-based person maybe, and then a hardcore open source person, have them both go at it and then come back and say, here's what we did, and then determine which one's the best based on that. Like almost like a death match. Any thoughts on that? If you're choosing a tool, if you would use that approach?
You know, I don't think I would use that approach, but this is my gut reaction because I haven't been asked this question before. My gut reaction is anything that is going to, by its nature, form camps that are going to be at odds with each other, it tends to not be healthy. Now, if you've got person A and person B and they've been working together very well for 5 or 6 years or whatever it is, and you know, they constantly have these conversation debates back and forth and the relationship's healthy, that's a different matter. But if we're really just talking about one zealot and another zealot, well, the zealots are going to gather their forces around them. You wind up with these two camps. One is going to win, and they're going to, at best, say, cool, why don't you come on and help us? And the other side, at best, is going to grudgingly come along. But what usually happens is there's pushback there. There's always the resentment. Then there's the chance that you get the competing initiatives. And it's something that always ends badly when you have those competing initiatives, in my experience, because you get into a bake-off, and then people are tuning their automation to be able to be this faster and that faster. Not that I've ever done this myself, you know, but it always tends to end poorly when it's set up as an opposition. But when you can have that sort of healthy tension, that's a different story. I would say it's case by case, but if I had to make a broad sweeping judgment on it, it would not be my first thing to go to.
Awesome. Yeah, great stuff, Paul. Another thing you mentioned was, and I know you have a whole presentation on this, so make sure you check out Paul at STPCon to check out this keynote live. I'm sure you have lots of examples, but can you give us one example from history that you mentioned that could help us with our judgment when we're trying to face these type of decisions that we face with automation or testing in general?
Well, sure. So it's one right out of the abstract, actually. So most of us have heard of the term Pyrrhic. Well, that term comes from an actual human in the past, King Pyrrhus of Epirus, who in the so-called Pyrrhic Wars of, I think it was 479 and 480 BC, he engaged the opposition forces and he won. But he sustained irreplaceable losses in those victories. I mean, just let that hang in there for you, right? You went in and you won. You won this battle. You won this war. But to the extent that your forces were depleted, that he could not replace them, one would ask, was that worthwhile? Was that a good judgment to engage in that endeavor? And from that, we get the term Pyrrhic victory. And that's a victory or a success whose value is not worth the cost. So what we have to do is when we go in and we get into automation, we get this tendency to want to do it all. We're going to automate everything, and we're going to automate end to end and every little nuance in between. And if we can't do that, then it failed. Then it failed. It's all or nothing. And part of being responsible is understanding where value is and where value is for your team, your organization, your company, as opposed to another team, another organization, another company, where the value propositions may be different. So you might make different decisions. You might exercise judgment differently because responsibility is context dependent. And then in the keynote, I give you two other examples of that. And at the end, I talk about responsibility being context dependent and take it back to one of the examples that I give toward the beginning of the talk and show where the context dependency was.
Awesome. I guess another question, Paul, someone might have is, what do you mean by context dependent?
So when I say context dependent, I mean that a decision that you make in one situation might seem irresponsible, because if I look at you and say, why in the hell did Joe just do that? In my context, in what I understand about the situation, it seems irresponsible. But what Joe understands about the situation, perhaps it is responsible, because either Joe doesn't have all the info that I do, or Joe has more info than I do. So he understands that there are two or three other facets to this decision that changed what the responsible decision was that I was not privy to. Therefore, it looks irresponsible to me.
Great. And I think this principle could apply to a lot of things with automation.
Absolutely.
Not only just selecting tools, but I believe you're also working on code reviews. So I'm just curious to know, does this also apply to code reviews? Like for me, when I'm doing a code review, I may see some code and go, you know what? I don't think this is right. I think you can handle it with a different algorithm. And then someone else may go respond back to me and say, no, that's a wrong algorithm for this particular issue. How do we know who's right in that particular context?
So yes, I am working on a presentation for automation code review. I gave it here locally just recently, and I'm looking forward to hopefully being able to give it at some national conferences here before too long. But what you touched on there is what I touch on. I call stewardship. I learned that particular term as it applies to testing and QA from a guy that I worked with a couple of years ago. And what he was saying was that QA wasn't the owner of quality. They were the stewards of quality. They're the ones who took care of quality on behalf of everyone else, but that they didn't do everything. They took care to make sure that other people were doing the right thing with them, right? So that's part of the testing. That's part of the questioning aspect of testing and QA. So here, there needs to be someone who is the steward, who is responsible for the stewardship of the automation initiative. And under that umbrella, part of that would be the steward for code reviews. And before you embark on code reviews, you need to have some way to break that tie. Does it go to the steward? Does it go to a panel? Is it always author wins? Is it always reviewer wins? Whatever it is, it matters and it doesn't matter. What matters is that it's known ahead of time. And we go in and we all know what the tiebreaker aspect of this thing is.
Awesome, Paul. And I think it also goes back to your points here on exercising good judgment. Sometimes people can be a stickler and say, nope, that can't be promoted to int. And they're like, well, we need to release this feature in order to get this out the door to make money. So I think probably judgment somehow comes into play there also.
Yes, because code reviews, really everything we do is about value. It really is about value, because if we're not getting good value out of what we're doing with our time and our money, our company isn't going to do well. We're not going to make profits, and the company's going to fold. We're all going to be out of jobs, right? So we're there to help this company make money by adding some expertise or multiple expertises, whatever the word for that is, to the company, to help everybody be successful so that the company is profitable and there's some longevity there. So if you're working on something that doesn't require a hardcore line-by-line code review, don't do it. Do a code walkthrough. Do a pair programming exercise where somebody just kind of has an eyeball on it. But hey, if you're writing software that's embedded in a pacemaker, yeah, maybe you want to have a few people sitting around a table going line by line, really, really looking at the code and understanding where any potential risks of performance problems, of security problems, of bugs might be, because the cost of failure there is so much higher than in, say, a $1.99 game off of an app store.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that concept. I definitely agree. What we do is we have to tag things as hazards. And so a hazard is something that could actually hurt someone. So I think when you see a hazard, you probably want to invest a little more effort in that to make sure you have quality and it's complete before you release that than, say, like a search feature. I know everything's important, but not everything has the same risk And so I guess you need to use judgment there to say, okay, which is going to incur money versus risk. So there's a play there of, a give and take, I guess.
Exactly. You value money over some things, but you value not killing someone over money is what I just heard.
Yes.
And that, and that's the right equation, right?
So Paul, also in this abstract, you mentioned Rube Goldberg. Who's Rube Goldberg? Or is that, I don't even know if a female or a male.
It's a male. So Rube Goldberg was a cartoonist back in the long time ago. I'm not exactly sure what year off the top of my head. But he became famous primarily for these cartoons that he drew. And he drew these wonderfully complex cartoons of these wonderfully complicated machines to do very simple things, like the automatic napkin. Where the guy lifts up the spoon and the spoon's attached to a string that goes to a parrot's perch. And what it does is it throws a cracker up in the air and then the parrot jumps up and does this and it gets all of that stuff. It's like the old game Mousetrap, which you built was effectively a Rube Goldberg machine that would, you know, drop the ball and then the little guy jumps in the bathtub and then there's something that rolls down something else. And if you built the mousetrap successfully, you would catch the mouse at the end or something along those lines. So it's the idea that you built this overly complex machine to do something. And we need to avoid or at least be aware if we are creating a Rube Goldberg machine in our automation initiatives because it's so easy to do that. Fighting for that Pyrrhic victory, fighting for that one last thing that we need to do, we add all this complication in where if we'd have just said, you know what, that last mile, the humans are going to do that. We took care of the first 99 miles with the computers. And now that's going to run tonight. And when I come in the morning, humans going to have a stack of results to go through that they're going to go through in a couple of hours. But it took the computer 9 hours overnight to generate those results for you. That's an effective use of time. That's an effective use of computers and is likely to be highly valuable. But sometimes it's viewed as a failure because we didn't go the Pyrrhic route. We didn't get that last thing where we can flip the switch and say yes or no, pass or fail.
Wow. Yeah, I definitely agree. Sometimes, like I said, this comes back to judgment, I guess, where people or knowledge, they hear automate and they think I need to automate everything. So they may automate a process that may be something that maybe only 1% of their user base actually uses and they only use it, you know, not that often. So you probably don't want to have to automate something like that. That's going to take a lot of time. You only run a few times. You don't get the value out of it.
Exactly. When I was at GameStop, we had a PC download client, and there was a feature that was called the deal of the day. And it would pop up, I think, randomly throughout the day. Or maybe it was always at the same time. I don't remember. But it would pop up, and it was basically a frameless window that had a graphic in it. And it was the graphic of whatever game that they were offering some huge discount on downloading for that day. And what you would do is you'd click on it and it would take you to that place in the catalog, or maybe it would even put it in your cart. I don't exactly remember. But to automate that was going to be difficult because, well, we didn't know what the image was supposed to be because it changed every day. So, okay, we could go to the database and sniff that out. Okay, great. So now we know what the name of the file is supposed to be. We don't know if it's actually displaying the right thing. And then did it go to the right place? Did it go to the right thing? Well, we could say, well, we think it's supposed to go here and all these other things. And there would have been some heuristics around that. We could have said it's probably with, 90% confidence it's working correctly. But a human was still going to have to do it anyway to make sure that the look and feel worked. And it was going to take 3 minutes to do it. Why would you automate that? Because a human was going to do it anyway. That was wasted. That would have been a Pyrrhic endeavor to say, yep, we got 100% automation when it wasn't valuable.
Awesome. Yeah, I also see this when people like mix domains. So they try to do a Rube Goldberg where they're doing this really complex end-to-end test. And you're like, well, couldn't this be better handled in a unit test? Or why are you populating this with 5,000 studies when that's more of a performance test? And this is something that you could do manually that they're doing already in a manual environment. So I think crossing these domains sometimes cause these like Rube Goldberg type automation situations.
That is absolutely a place. Another place is when you cross technology boundaries. Hmm. oh, hey, wait a minute. I can't click that thing with Flash because of the way the Flash has been compiled. Let me get Securely and bake that into my automation framework so I can click these Flash buttons. Perhaps that's the right decision, but understand that you've built at least part of a Rube Goldberg machine there, because now you have added restrictions on what you can and can't do with a machine while that test script is running. And you've baked in a certain amount of uncertainty because of the way the image matching works.
No, that's an awesome point. And you get in trouble a lot of times in those situations when you do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think you might agree, like any code situation, I think less code, the better, less to maintain,
yes.
Less you have to. Same thing with automation. I love automation, but people go out of control with automation and it's going to kill them in the end because it's an investment. So it's not just automate and you're all done. It's automate. And by the way, you need to maintain this throughout your application. Every time it changes, you're going to need to touch code and maintain code and code reviews. And so less is more, I think.
And that's one of the big myths, fallacies, or whatever the right term is here, is that the cost of automation is writing the scripts up front the first time.
Mm.
Over time, it is not. Over time, it is maintenance if you have not done some forethought about how you are going to maintain these things. So I'm okay taking a little hit in test case create or test script creation time on a per test script basis if it means I'm going to greatly reduce my maintenance time release over release, because it's going to come out in your favor in the long run.
Awesome. Great stuff, Paul. I know we just touched the tip of the iceberg. I recommend everyone highly check out STPCon. I believe this talk is going to be September 28th, 2017 at 9 a.m. So head on over to stpcon.com and sign up and check out Paul while you're there and say hi. You heard him on Test Talks. That'd be awesome. Okay, Paul, though, before we go, though, is there one piece of actual advice you can give us to improve our judgment as we're deciding what tools we should use or when we're doing automation? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
So my one piece of advice that I always give is go for value. If it's not going to provide value now, later, at some point, if it's not going to bring value, if it's not worth your time, don't do it. Do something else. That is the one piece of advice that I can really give. And it applies to everything, but obviously I'm focused on an automation. I've got an automation focus here, but think about value as opposed to anything else first. And then a lot of the other decisions are just going to fall out of there. And I think you'll be more responsible with your decision-making that way. And then as far as contacting me, you can find me on Twitter at P. Grizzaffi. You can also find me on LinkedIn. And I will be at a few different places that you can check out. I'm speaking at the online testing conference. I'm doing a couple of local meetups, special events sponsored by Magenic in Irvine. Obviously, SDPCon, where I'm fortunate enough to give the keynote. And I will be at my first Test Bash this year, Test Bash Philly, on November 9th and 10th. And you can also find me on my blog, responsibleautomation.wordpress.com.
Thank you, Paul, for your test automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value we covered in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com. And in the search, type in 159. And while you're there, make sure to click on the free trial button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Lab's awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, why not share it with a friend or coworker? And together, we can help share automation awesomeness to the masses. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with creating automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.